Okay, let's begin by reciting the Heart Sutra together, just so that slowly over these days we start to become at least familiar with the words and then hopefully a little bit the meaning as we go through the days. So, just on the first page, yeah? The Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharivatriputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this: correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odour, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration, without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared: Tayata Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasam Gati Bodhisvaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you've indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharivatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. So let's put the context of how the Heart Sutra fits within all the teachings of the Buddha. So let's go back a little bit in the history. So Shakyamuni Buddha, of course, was born as Prince Siddhartha, 563 BC. And when he was born, and he was born in a place that's now called Lumbini in modern-day Nepal, and he was the son of the king of the whole region. And the king was told by the wise man of the court that this boy would either become a great ruler himself or a great spiritual leader. So, of course, the king did everything in his power to educate the prince in the way of becoming the next king. So he surrounded him with all the luxuries of the palace and so forth. But then as the prince was growing up, he went out on a couple of trips outside the palace. He saw the harsh realities of life. He saw suffering, aging, sickness, death. And he also saw a wandering holy man who seemed to be very much content with his life. And this got the prince thinking about the meaning of life and what is, are we just born to suffer, to get old and to die? And so he decided he needed to find out the truth. So he escaped from the palace at age 29 and went out in search of the truth. And he had a number of teachers, and at that time a lot of the spiritual traditions felt that the way to overcome suffering was to develop higher and higher levels of concentration. So he developed very high levels of samadhi, and part of the traditions at the time, it was felt that it was really craving and attachment that was the main problem, particularly also craving and attachment to the body. So part of the practices was these sort of ascetic practices of denying the body. So the prince spent 5-6 years doing these ascetic practices, not really feeding the body at all, and he was on the point of death from starvation when he really understood that this path was also an extreme, that previously he was in the extreme of indulgence in the palace, and now he'd simply gone to the other extreme of a denial of asceticism. And so he then abandoned his teachers, took some food, and went out in search of the truth. And what happened next, I'd like to read from this book here, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Because he puts it in a very nice way, and that will be the basis, set the basis for the next topic that I want to cover. It's on page 33, if anyone has this book. He says, through many years of contemplation and penance, Siddhartha remained steadfast in his determination to find the root cause of suffering and to ease his own suffering and the suffering of others. He headed to Magadha in the heart of India to continue his meditation. Along the way he met a grass seller named Sotia, who offered him a handful of kusha grass. Siddhartha recognized this as an auspicious sign. In ancient Indian culture, kusha grass was considered a cleansing substance. Instead of continuing his journey, he decided to stop and meditate right there. He found a place to sit on the flat stones under a nearby ficus religiosa tree, using the kusha grass as a mat. Silently he vowed, "This body may rot, I may disintegrate into the dust, but until I find the answer, I will not rise." As Siddhartha sat in contemplation beneath the tree, he did not go unnoticed. Mara, the king of the demons, heard Siddhartha's vow and sensed the strength of his resolve. Mara grew sleepless, for he knew that within Siddhartha existed the potential to throw his entire domain into chaos. Being a strategic warrior, he sent 5 of his most beautiful daughters to distract and seduce the prince. As the girls set out, they had full confidence in their seductive talents. But as they approached the meditating Siddhartha, their beauty began to vanish. They withered and aged, they grew warts, and a stench rose from their skin. Siddhartha did not stir. The dejected apsaras returned to their father, who was furious. How dare anyone refuse his daughters? In his rage, Mara summoned his retinue, a great army furnished with every imaginable weapon. Mara's army attacked in full force, but to their dismay, all the arrows, spears, stones and catapults aimed at Siddhartha transformed into a rain of flowers as soon as they came within reach of their target. After many long hours of unsuccessful warfare, Mara and his army were exhausted and defeated. Finally, Mara came to Siddhartha and with all his diplomacy tried to talk him into giving up his quest. Siddhartha said he could not give up after all these lifetimes of trying. Mara asked, "How can we be so sure you have been struggling for so long?" Siddhartha answered, "I don't need validation. The earth is my witness." And with this he touched the ground, the earth shook, and Mara evaporated into thin air. Thus Siddhartha found liberation and became a Buddha. He had discovered the path to end suffering at its very root, not only for himself but for all people. The place of his final battle against Mara is now called Bodh Gaya, and the tree under which he sat is called the Bodhi tree. This is the story that Buddhist mothers have told their children for many generations. So when we look at that story, of course, we could take that story literally, that there was a demon, Mara, there was an army, there was the daughters. But actually, when we look at it, we can understand that these three things are symbolic of three inner demons that Prince Siddhartha overcame. Ignorance, attachment, aversion. These are called three poisons because they poison our mind. And so in the story, of course, Mara is symbolizing ignorance, the daughters is symbolizing attachment, and the army is symbolizing aversion. So these are the three inner demons that Prince Siddhartha overcame to achieve enlightenment, to become Buddha. And we'll be looking at these three poisons in more detail in the coming days, of course, particularly focusing on this ignorance. Now, Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment in Bodh Gaya, and then he went on to teach what he had discovered for another 45 years. He achieved enlightenment at age 35. And so what he taught, of course, was how to overcome the suffering, and that this suffering or this unsatisfactory state we find ourselves in is really coming from our ignorance of misunderstanding reality. Now, this can be described at a number of levels depending on our capacity. And the Buddha taught according to the capacity of the people. And so he taught what's called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And so I'd like to present those now so that we can see how the Heart Sutra fits within all of this. So the first turning of the wheel of Dharma is actually called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths was actually the very first teaching that the Buddha gave after achieving enlightenment. And he gave this teaching in a place called in a place called Sarnath, nearby Varanasi. So, just to introduce this, I'd like to read a little bit from His Holiness's book. It's on page 25, if anyone has the book. He says the following about this first turning of the wheel. Shortly after attaining enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha gave a sermon in Varanasi, sharing the fruits of his realization. This sermon is referred to as the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. The word Dharma here refers to the Buddha's teachings themselves. It was this sermon in which the Buddha developed what would become the framework for the entirety of his teachings, the Four Noble Truths. These four truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of its origin, the truth of the possibility of its cessation, and the truth of the path that leads to that cessation. In essence, the Four Noble Truths say that we all naturally desire happiness and do not wish to suffer, and that the suffering we wish to avoid comes about as a result of a chain of causes and conditions begun even before our birth. If we are to pursue our aspiration to gain freedom from suffering, we need to clearly understand the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering and to strive to eliminate them. Additionally, we must clearly understand the causes and conditions that give rise to happiness as well, and actively practice them. This is the essence of the Four Noble Truths. So let's have a little bit of a look at the Four Noble Truths. Now, the Four Noble Truths, often when the Four Noble Truths are described, then a simple analogy is used to better understand the Four Noble Truths. You'll find this in many topics in Buddhism. Simple analogies are often used to help understand something a little bit more profound or difficult to understand. With the Four Noble Truths, then the analogy that's often used is the analogy of a physical illness. And so, with a physical illness, of course, if we think we have some physical illness, the first thing we would normally do, of course, is we go to the doctor. And why do we go to the doctor? Because we believe that the doctor is someone qualified to help diagnose and hopefully cure our physical illness. So then with the physical illness, of course, when we go to the doctor, the first thing the doctor would do would be, of course, the diagnosis. And generally the diagnosis has two parts to it. The first part is to examine what sort of condition we find ourselves in. So maybe they do blood tests or check our heart or, you know, all sorts of tests. So basically looking at all of our symptoms. And then, of course, based on the symptoms and all the tests that they would run, they would try to determine what is the underlying illness that is manifesting in this way. And the analogy that we're using here for the Four Noble Truths is a curable illness. So what comes after diagnosis, of course, is prognosis. So prognosis, of course, here we're using the example of a curable disease. So the doctor's prognosis would be that we can achieve a healthy state, that this is something that can be cured. And then, of course, following the prognosis comes the cure, the remedy. And so, like this, the Buddha is being like our doctor in the Four Noble Truths teaching. And in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's diagnosis for us, the first noble truth is, what condition do we find ourselves in? And here, this is often listed in English as suffering. But I think this translation here can be confusing or sometimes even misleading. There are in fact many terms in the original Pali and Sanskrit language for which in English there's no precise word that means the same thing. So here the original word within the Four Noble Truths is the word dukkha. So what is our human condition in the original teachings is that we're in this state of dukkha. And that's most commonly translated as suffering. But that can lead to a lot of confusion. Because when we see this, and we hear things like saying, like, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering, then we think, well, that doesn't sound right. Because sometimes I have a bit of happiness, a bit of pleasure in my life. So it doesn't seem to me like I'm suffering all the time. So the problem here, of course, is terminology. That this word suffering here in the Four Noble Truths is a translation of the word dukkha. And the word dukkha has a much broader meaning than what we normally associate with the word suffering. For us, the word suffering implies some sort of unpleasant, painful physical or mental experience. Whereas the word dukkha is much broader meaning than that. And to understand this word dukkha, then we can talk about the three types or three levels of dukkha. The first is the dukkha of suffering, meaning that part of the human condition is, yes, sometimes we do have, in fact, unpleasant, painful physical, mental experiences. So this is referring to our unpleasant experiences. So this one is obvious that we don't really want this. You know, this is really unsatisfactory, so that's pretty easy to understand. The second level or type of dukkha was given the name change. And here the Buddha was describing our pleasant experiences, which we normally would label as happiness. So why is it that the Buddha used the word change to describe these? Is that exactly that? They change, they come to an end. Meaning that all of our pleasant experiences we've ever had, are having, will have, will come to an end. Not only that, but these pleasant experiences are not reliable. Meaning we can't just click our fingers and have a pleasant experience when we want one. They require some sort of causes and conditions to come together. They require some stimulus to be there. And these experiences are also not in the nature of happiness. They're simply a relative experience. For example, the classic example to show that is they often talk about, imagine being in a cold room, you look outside, it's nice and sunny, and you go, oh, it looks so nice out there. And we go and sit in the sun and go, oh, so wonderful. But if that pleasant experience of sitting in the sun was in the nature of happiness, it would mean the longer we sat in the sun, the happier we should become. But we know that's not the case. We get sunburnt, dehydrated, maybe we get too hot, and then we look in the room and go, oh, so cool, so nice in the room. And so we go back in the room. So from that analogy, we can understand that our pleasant experiences are relative experiences. Relative to a previous state, they're an improvement. But if we overindulge in them, they often turn into suffering themselves. So if we can understand that here, that our pleasant experiences are simply transient, temporary experiences, not reliable because they need a stimulus to be there, and they're only relative experiences, then we won't be chasing after pleasant experiences hoping that they're going to satisfy us. So this is what the Buddha was saying here, is please understand your pleasant experiences for what they are. If you don't and you go grasping at them, you're just going to induce a lot of suffering in terms of frustration when you don't get them, overindulging in them, and turning into actual physical and mental suffering as well. So this is part of the human condition. But underlying both those pleasant and unpleasant experiences, the third level of dukkha, the most deep level, is often translated as all-pervasive dukkha, meaning that there is nowhere we can go or be to be completely free of the potential of some sort of suffering to arise. There's always this potential there, that given certain conditions come together, we will suffer. So this is, at the deepest level, why our human condition is unsatisfactory. So unpleasant experiences are unsatisfactory. This is very easy to understand. Pleasant experiences are unsatisfactory. Why? Because they don't last. And at the deepest level, our life, our human condition is unsatisfactory because there's always a potential for suffering to arise. And what this points to is the reason there is a potential for suffering to arise is because our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions. Mental afflictions such as anger, craving, jealousy, resentment, fear, anxiety. As long as these mental afflictions are in our mind, there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise. So this is what is meant by the word dukkha. It covers all of these things. And so, therefore, to avoid the confusion of the word suffering, some translators translate dukkha as unsatisfactory. So this is how we are to understand the basic human condition. Any questions about that? Anything not clear?
I'm still like debating about the love, you know, like for a couple. Like it doesn't fit exactly in that. I mean, because when I'm thinking about it, I mean, I can understand like all of the attachment and so on and so on. But love for one another, it's like a bit, it's not exactly an attachment.
No, it's not. That's correct. Correct. And we're going to look at that difference again.
Okay.
It's coming.
So I need to, you know,
Yeah, we're going to look at that difference. I think it comes tomorrow morning already. Or tomorrow afternoon. Tomorrow sometime.
Okay.
We're going to look at that. Okay? What is the underlying cause? Why are we stuck in this unsatisfactory state? That's the second noble truth. The truth of the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. Now, within these Four Noble Truths teachings here, then in the second noble truth, and remember the Four Noble Truths is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions, whether Theravada or Mahayana. And generally within the Theravada traditions, when they look at this second noble truth, what is mentioned here as the underlying cause or origin is craving or attachment. And I think the reason that it's listed as in that way in the Theravada traditions is that at a practical level, craving and attachment is the main driving force in our life. Because it's said that we live in this desire realm. But actually, when you dig a little bit deeper, we can understand that this craving is coming from ignorance. This fundamental ignorance, misunderstanding how we exist in the world around us exists. So when this second noble truth is presented within the Mahayana traditions, then as what is mentioned as the cause, in fact there are two things mentioned as the cause. So generally in the Mahayana traditions, when they look at the second noble truth, they say that the underlying cause or origin of our current state is our mental afflictions and our actions. So the mental afflictions, of course, are things like anger and jealousy and craving and resentment, fear, anxiety. But within the mental afflictions, then what is underlying all of those is this fundamental ignorance. So we saw in the story of the Buddha, the Prince Siddhartha, when he was trying to achieve enlightenment, that the daughters came to try to seduce him. So this is the craving or attachment. And he overcame that. Then the army tried to attack him. That was symbolic of anger or aversion. So he overcame that. But then the last thing was the Mara tried to sort of convince him he didn't know what he was doing. So this Mara, of course, is symbolizing ignorance, and eventually he overcame that. So underneath all of these mental afflictions is this mind of ignorance, the misunderstanding of how we exist and the world around us exists. That leads to all of our mental afflictions, attachment, aversion, craving, jealousy. That is driving our behavior. So our actions are being motivated by these mental afflictions, and then our actions, of course, lead to our various experiences. So that full process of how this works, we're going to look at in quite some detail in a couple of days' time. So just to briefly mention it here now. So of course, then the Buddha, his prognosis was very good. which is the third noble truth, is that we can be cured of this unsatisfactory state of dukkha. So the third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the ending of suffering. We can achieve a healthy state. We can become liberated from this state of dukkha. Now, of course, we are, from the Buddhist perspective, we're not just stuck in this state of dukkha in this life, but we're stuck in this state life after life after life. And this cycling life after life after life in this state is called samsara. And if we can overcome this cycle of samsara and we can be liberated from this state of dukkha, then this state of liberation, state of cessation, is often called nirvana. So cessation, of course, means the ending of suffering, the ceasing of suffering. So remember, samsara and nirvana are not places. This is not samsara. And nirvana is not some place we end up in when we get out of this place. Samsara and nirvana are states of mind. If our mind has mental afflictions and ignorance, we're in samsara. If we get rid of that, we're in a state of nirvana. Same world, completely different experience. How do we achieve this goal? What is the remedy or the cure? Is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So these are, of course, all the practices that we need to engage in order to achieve this goal. And we're going to have a look at that in a little bit more detail later in the course. So this is the Four Noble Truths, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. So is there any questions about this? Again, this is just a brief introduction for now. We'll go into it in a little bit more detail later.
Maybe that will be for later, but perhaps at some point you could explain the difference between nirvana and enlightenment.
Yeah, that's definitely
between coming. Theravada and Mahayana, but also within Mahayana, I think they use nirvana as some earlier stage.
Yes, that I'll talk about that, and also actually later in the Heart Sutra, I'm also going to talk about this nirvana enlightenment. It actually directly comes in the Heart Sutra towards the end, but before that, I'm also going to talk about that. So you'll get an answer. Okay. Now, within these Four Noble Truths teachings, in this cause or origin, then what is the ignorance that we are suffering from? Is this grasping onto self. Grasping onto self. So, here within the Four Noble Truths teachings, then to achieve this personal liberation from samsara, the Vipassana practice, as we've briefly already seen, we need to come to realize selflessness, no self. And in these Four Noble Truths system of teachings, the ignorance again is this overinflating this sense of me, grasping onto this solid me, which we call self. And within these Four Noble Truths teachings, with respect to the world around us, there's no problem. There is an objective world out there, independent of us. And that world is made up of these very tiny little particles. And so what's being taught here in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma with regard to the physical world is a little bit similar to like classical physics, you know, atomic theory, subatomic theory. There is an objective world there. That's not a problem. The problem is how we see ourselves. We overinflate the sense of me. That's the problem. So that's what the Buddha taught in the Four Noble Truths, the first turning of the wheel. But then he went on to the second turning of the wheel. Which often is called, translated as the wheel of without characteristics. And this was taught mainly in a place called Rajgir, which we're going to see, of course, coming up in the Heart Sutra. And to introduce again this second turning of the wheel, let's have a look again in His Holiness's book very briefly on page 41. He says the following: in order to fully understand the Heart Sutra, we must understand its place within the entire canon of Buddhist literature. The Heart Sutra is part of the Perfection of Wisdom literature, which is composed of distinctly Mahayana texts. These Mahayana texts form the core of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. The Mahayana teachings are rooted in the sermons that the Buddha taught primarily at Vulture's Peak, whereas the teachings of the first turning emphasize suffering and its cessation, the teachings of the second turning emphasize emptiness. So here, in the second turning of the wheel, again, mainly taught in this area called Rajgir, which now is about a 2-hour drive from Bodh Gaya. It's again in modern day Bihar. And as His Holiness mentioned, the Heart Sutra is part of the second turning of the wheel. And these teachings in this second turning of the wheel are collectively often called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And there are many Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. There are three that are often emphasized, often called the Three Mothers. The Three Mothers. And they are the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 100,000 stanzas or verses. So that's called the Extensive Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Very big. Then there's the Middling Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, which only has 25,000 stanzas or verses. And then the Brief Perfection of Wisdom Sutra just has 8,000 verses. So they're called the Three Mothers there because they're drawn on a lot in this discussion about particularly emptiness. Whereas the Heart Sutra here, and that's why we're going to see what the word heart means. The word heart means here essence, the heart of the matter. The essence, meaning that the Heart Sutra is a Perfection of Wisdom Sutra that only has 25 stanzas or verses. So it contains the essence of all of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings in very few words. That's what the word heart here means in the Heart Sutra. So here, in the second turning of the wheel, the Buddha went on to say that there is a deeper level of ignorance operating than merely this idea of self, this overinflating the sense of me. In fact, here, within the second turning of the wheel, the ignorance that we're talking about is the ignorance grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. So the Vipassana practice that we're talking about here is that we need to overcome this ignorance. We need to come to realize there's no independent me, no independent objective world. So here the Vipassana practice is, of course, this wisdom of emptiness. In Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness again doesn't mean nothing really exists. Emptiness means that everything is empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently. So this idea in the second turning of the wheel, so remember in the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha said there is an objective world there, made up of these very tiny particles. So again, that's a little bit similar to the classical physics idea of atomic theory, subatomic theory. In the second turning of the wheel, he's saying, in fact, there is no independent objective world out there. So that idea of emptiness at least has some parallel, a little bit, to a little bit more quantum theory, quantum physics. Because I got two quotes here from two prominent quantum physicists in the past who said, first one's a quote from Niels Bohr, who says, "An independent reality in the ordinary physical sense can neither be ascribed to the phenomena nor to the agencies of observation." And then there's another quote from another well-known quantum physicist, Werner Heisenberg, who said, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." So, of course, I'm not suggesting that quantum physicists accept emptiness as described in Buddhism. But I think at least some physicists' interpretation of quantum mechanics seems to be not too different from the idea of emptiness. But of course there's no uniform acceptance of what quantum mechanics implies. There are a lot of different competing theories amongst the physicists. Also in the second turning of the wheel, so remember in the first turning of the wheel, we're talking about the goal of personal liberation from samsara. So we're talking about the goal of nirvana, personal liberation. In the second turning of the wheel, we then not only talk about a deeper level of the vipassana practice, but we also talk about the goal of enlightenment. And as we're going to see, enlightenment is actually a further step than nirvana. That in enlightenment, the goal of enlightenment is not just personal liberation from samsara, in that this aspiration of bodhicitta is the aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help liberate everyone else from samsara as well. So we're talking about enlightenment as the goal of trying to help liberate everyone from samsara. What the difference between nirvana and enlightenment really is, we're going to be starting to look at that tomorrow. So we're going to look at that. And of course, there are different assertions about what the differences are, but we'll look at that tomorrow. So this is the second turning of the wheel. So this is where the Heart Sutra is coming, within that second turning of the wheel. It's part of this Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Is that clear? Anything there?
So why did the Buddha say two different things, that there is a conforming to the classical physics and quantum physics?
According to people's capacity. For example, an analogy in our modern day, in our everyday life, is I think when we went to school, even in primary school, we probably learnt about atoms and molecules, didn't we? And usually, at least when I went to school, when they talked about atoms, they said there was this round thing here called a nucleus, and then whizzing around it were these little round things called electrons, little round things whizzing around it. Is that what an atom sort of looks like, really? I think not. I don't think any physicists would accept that model now. But for a primary school child, that's a useful concept to begin to understand what we mean by atoms and molecules. And then in high school we learn something a little bit different, and then if we go into university and really study physics, we probably, you know, understand something at a more deep level than this model. So like that, we have the different teachings from the Buddha according to people's capacity of understanding. And what we're going to see, particularly tomorrow, is that these teachings are like stepping stones. They help us to move to the deepest view. I mean, it wouldn't really be helpful to try to teach this theory as it really is taught at university to a primary school child. They'd just sort of look at it and go, what's that? You know, they wouldn't understand anything, would they?
So, but how should we regard ourselves as first step, or because we are maybe all in primary school, or so why do we get the second step?
That's it. So that's the thing, is that if we are presented with, let's say, four views, this is the most simple, then deeper, we can look at those and sort of see where we, in our own understanding, roughly is. And then we can use those as stepping stones to get to the deeper view. And they are very helpful. Each one is very helpful for the next, to understand the next deeper level. So that's what we're going to be looking at. See, normally, when we talk about this nature of reality, particularly in the Tibetan system, we only ever really hear about this idea. Whereas there are at least two or three more simple ideas that can support that. And normally we don't hear about those. And so then we're only presented with this. But if we're somewhere here and we're listening to this, we go, what's that? That doesn't make any sense. Whereas if we're somewhere here and we hear something around about that same level, we'll go, oh yeah, I can understand that. And then we can go to the next one. So that can be very helpful. And that's what we're going, even though the Heart Sutra is only talking about this, what I'm going to do is present these other ideas as well. And so then hopefully we can have some stepping stones. Because here, you know, it's easy to say, oh, everything's empty of inherent existence. You know, we can mouth that pretty quick, easy. And it flows off and, yeah, that's okay, I understand, I believe that. But do we? Probably not. So that's why these earlier views can be very helpful. And these earlier views can be found in this level of teachings, but also in the third wheel, which I haven't mentioned yet. But I'm going to talk about these different levels in detail starting tomorrow, and then through the Heart Sutra I'm going to refer back to them when they're useful to have some comparison. Okay. Actually, we're sort of running out of time, so rather than throwing out the third wheel quickly, maybe I'll just briefly introduce it and talk about it tomorrow morning. The third turning of the wheel is called fine discrimination. And this third turning of the wheel, there's really two parts to that. One is that when we hear this idea of emptiness, you know, nothing exists, has its own unique nature, if we don't have a good basis, it sort of seems like this seems to mean that nothing really exists. And so if we don't have a good basis, then if we try to understand this, we'll simply flip to the extreme of nihilism, thinking that, oh, this means nothing really exists. In fact, there are quite a number of modern day philosophers, non-Buddhist philosophers, who look at these works within Buddhism, particularly the works of great Indian masters such as Nagarjuna, who presented a lot of things here, And many of these modern-day philosophers say of Nagarjuna that he's a nihilist, that his this view is equivalent to nihilism. So we're talking about very intelligent philosophers. So if they can come to the conclusion that this sort of seems to mean that nothing exists, I mean, it's easy for us, I think, to do the same. So part of the third turning of the wheel is a teaching that sort of helps us as a stepping stone to really understand what that means. And part of the third turning of the wheel is also talking more about the subjective experience of emptiness, and actually in that way particularly talking about the idea of Buddha nature. And this can be a very good bridge into what's called Tantra or Vajrayana practice, which is again a deeper level of practice. So there are really two aspects to this third turning of the wheel, which I'd like to talk about, but we've run out of time, so I'll come back to that tomorrow morning in the first session tomorrow morning. So I'll just mention that now. So there's more to be talked about here, but again, I'll leave that till tomorrow morning. So I think on that note, we'll have a break there. So it's time for dinner now. So again, silence has begun, so silence to the end of the course now. And this evening you'll be doing meditation with Jonas. So again, mainly focusing more on that sort of compassion wing of the practice will be this evening. In fact, you'll be sort of talking about or reflecting on what's called these eight worldly concerns, to really understand how we are really looking for happiness and suffering out there, and to understand to turn our mind inwards, because that's the beginning point of the whole spiritual path. So you're going to be looking at that a little bit this evening. Okay? So let's have some dinner, and I'll see you tomorrow morning.